chilling, you know, to know that, you know, the most notorious loyalist paramilitary, a serial killer who had been linked to, by the time he died, he was linked to something like 50 murders. He is like a terrible thread running through my book. My mom said to me when I was something like 8 years old, this old neighbor who lived down, mom told me that she had died. And my response was, who shot her? In other words, I couldn't conceive of an elderly person dying of anything else other than violence. You know, there are other people, civilians, who died violently, who were murdered, who were shot dead on their doorstep, who were blown up in a shop waiting for a lift home. And there's no memorial to them.
Martin, thank you very much for joining me. I finished off the book there last night. Unreal. I don't think I'd personally read a non-IRA or non-kind of loyalist book about the Troubles. The ones I read tend to be from the point of view of those like fighting in it. But yours is quite different. And were you happy with the way the book turned out? It was quite a project.
I think one of the most important things for me was that it would be non-partisan. Obviously, I'm from a Catholic nationalist background, if you like, from the north of Ireland, from a rural part of County Down. But, you know, my intention telling the story of the Troubles in my local area, in my parish or my neighbourhood, if you like, was always to kind of tell the story from all sides, because, you know, some people grow up in a particularly Catholic area, some people grow up in a predominantly Protestant area. I grew up kind of, you know, an interface would probably be the wrong word, because that kind of suggests Catholics on one side, Protestants on the other. I grew up in a rural area where Catholics and Protestants lived pretty much side by side and largely, you know, got on pretty well, you know, obviously with exceptions, but generally, even at the worst of the Troubles, there was, you know, people had friends from either side of the community, people worked alongside each other. And so the story of the Troubles, as far as I'm concerned, is the story of violence done to both Catholics and Protestants and people of, you know, of no particular faith. And I really wanted to communicate that. So, like, Catholics and Protestants are buried in separate graveyards and, you know, where I'm from. But I very much wanted their stories to lie side by side in chapters in my book. It's told chronologically, pretty much, except it starts with the last two murders in my parish. But otherwise, it starts with the first people who were killed in the Troubles, which is three British soldiers in an abandoned house in the north of the parish in 1972. And then it finishes with a local councillor who dies of a heart attack in a loyalist bomb scare as late as 1997. So over the course of 25 years, more than 20 people are killed in my parish, which is only a few square miles, a kind of a rural area. Again, you know, when people think of the Troubles, I think the primary images they have are of Belfast and Derry and maybe Newry and Portadown, sort of big towns and cities, whereas I'm telling the story of, you know, what happened in small villages and remote country farmhouses. You know, these are the killing fields as I knew them and growing up in my part of rural County Down. The part of the north that I'm from, is another thing that's sort of striking about it is, although it's very much in the countryside, it has a history of industrial development. Like, the linen industry grew up around there in the north, because it lies, my village and the villages, other villages in the parish lie along the River Bann, and it was kind of developed. A reservoir was built off it, and the power of that was used to power linen mills along the river, and also bleach greens where the linen was sort of laid out in the fields. you know, I would describe it as kind of the fields were shrouded by these kind of huge bolts of cloth, of linen cloth that was used to dry or to, sorry, to bleach, to whiten naturally in the open air. And I kind of use that as a metaphor. The linen industry was quite a dirty industry. Like one of the epigraphs from the book comes from a poem by Seamus Heaney, which uses the method of one of the processes of creating linen. He uses it as a kind of a metaphor for the stench of sectarianism that has always tainted the North, going back to the times of the plantations. I use linen and some of the things associated with linen as a kind of a running metaphor through the book, like vitriol or bleach is another word for industrial bleach, and it is used along with sunlight to whiten linen. And I also, like, vitriol is also a kind of a description of violent language or sort of speech. And so I kind of introduce or one of the victims in my book, a man two of whose sons were murdered, and he describes how Ian Paisley, the loyalist pastor and politician, how he came to the local area and preached hatred against Catholics in the local Orange Hall. And so I use the term vitriol, which is one associated with the linen industry. I associate that with the language of Ian Paisley and how he again polluted the climate in the north. And I see him as one of the instigators of the troubles, even though he himself didn't use violence. I think by the violence of his language and the prejudice that he fostered, I think he was very much one of the instigators of the troubles, as much as the IRA or as much as the British Army in the heavy-handed way and the partial way in which they got involved in the communal conflict in the north. Sorry, that's a very long-winded answer.
No, you're grand. You're grand. Sorry, I actually managed to we introduced the book without giving the title. The title is Dirty Linen, as people will know now. There's a very good quote. I think it's early in the book. It says about being aware of history but not weaponizing it, and that's something that I think the book did very well. It showed like pain and loss from all different sides. There was even a part where it was a father and son RUC officer who were killed by the IRA, and you went into the pain and trauma that that caused. It was by no means just focusing on what the loyalists or the British Army did, like.
Yeah, absolutely. No, like I said, it's very important to me, you know, to show side by side, the victims from whatever community they came from. So the case you're mentioning there is Bobby Harrison, who was an RUC man, an RUC reservist, when he was shot dead in his native village of Guildford. And I interviewed his son called Robert, you know, it's pretty much the same name as his father. And he himself was an RUC reservist at the same time. A bit like Saving Private Ryan, this thing where you couldn't have, you know, all the soul or members of the family all serving together. Well, just a few months before his father was murdered, the RUC issued a similar instruction that up until then, Robert, who I interviewed, and Bobby, his father, who was later murdered, they used to sort of travel around in the same car. So, you know, it could very possibly have been the case that Robert could have ended up getting shot alongside his father. So my point in that case was, so Bobby Harrison was a local man, and my mother knew him when she was a little girl and he was a few years older. And at that time he was working as an apprentice butcher in my village. And so, you know, what I like to communicate is that, you know, this is me not writing about complete strangers. This is me writing about, you know, maybe the parents of people I went to school with. Like, I've interviewed people that I went to school with, you know, whose father was murdered, for example. Another person I interviewed is married to someone I went to school with, and her father was murdered. So this is a very, you know, a personal and a very intimate account of the Troubles for me. The point I wanted to make about Bobby Harrison is, as well as the fact that he was murdered, he was shot dead by the IRA in the village where he was born and grew up and lived all his life, is that he wasn't just an RUC man, and prior to that he was in the UDR and he was in the B specials. Now, I would have my own views about some of the things that the RUC did, some of the things that the UDR and the B specials did. They were far from perfect. But as well as all of that, he was the longest serving nurse in a local hospital for people with special needs. So you can be kind of paint somebody as, you can just see the uniform. And my intention and my ambition is to try and persuade people to look beyond the uniform, not to other victims, by sort of saying, oh, well, he was in the RUC and they were discriminated against Catholics, and when the civil rights movement was fighting for justice and equality, the RUC were involved in beating protesters, civil, peaceful protesters off the streets. That may be true, and that is true, but that is not to justify their murder. And my point is that these people can, it's wrong to just sort of reduce people to the uniform that they were and to kind of dehumanize them in that way. And I'm trying to sort of hopefully persuade people to read the stories and to understand that these people did not deserve their fate, and also to try and understand the repercussions. It's one thing to kind of to kill British soldiers, and not that I'm defending that, but my point would be, those British soldiers are buried back in Hull or in Orkney or wherever else. The Protestant members of the RUC and the UDR, when they were murdered, they lived in the north. They lived in that community. They had roots there going back centuries. And to kill members of the security forces is to, that has repercussions. And a lot of, A, they didn't deserve to die themselves, and B, the consequences of that often was that local Catholics, innocent Catholic civilians, would also be sort of targeted by loyalist paramilitaries. I'm not saying that violence didn't happen, or innocent Catholics weren't killed before the IRA started its campaign of violence in 1970. They were the first murders of the Troubles were in 1966 by loyalist paramilitaries, Gusty Spence, one of the founder of the modern UVF. But if you look at the escalation of violence post 1970, I defy anyone to sort of say that the spate of killings by Republican paramilitaries, it helped create an atmosphere in which extreme elements in the loyalist community pretty much had a free rein to wage war on the Catholic population in the north.
Sorry, maybe just more for some of the North American listeners. The north, the six counties of Northern Ireland, it's about the size of Connecticut. We're talking about an area the size of Connecticut. For most of the conflict, the population was like 1.4 to 1.6 million. And obviously your parish again much smaller. Just to provide a bit of context. One of the things the book kind of does a lot of things. It gives a history of your own life, your community. One of them that stood out for me the most was it provides like a collection of these smaller ways that that a conflict kind of interrupts everyday normal life and just affects it. You know, I'm thinking of like cars not being allowed to be left unattended on the highway or on the high street, excuse me. There was a story about a farmer who got trampled by his own cattle because a bomb went off like 8 miles in the distance. And these things you'd never think of unless you live there. You know, it provided so many of them for me.
Yeah, like so, like this is, you know, I was drawing very much on, you know, my own personal memories of growing up. Like I was born in 1967. The conflict kind of, you know, broke out 68, 69. Like the first murders locally in my parish were in 1972. You know, things that sort of stood out in my memory were, as you say, this thing of, you know, when my parents went shopping in the local town, Banbridge, on a Saturday, me and my sister and my two brothers would be kind of left sitting in the car because you weren't allowed to leave a car unattended on the high street for fear that there would be a bomb in it and, you know, it could go off and kill shoppers and so forth. So basically, our presence as children in the car was like a reassurance to the security forces patrolling the high street that there wasn't a bomb in the vehicle because we were there. But I genuinely remember the longer we were left, maybe after an hour, you know yourself, if you're sitting waiting with nothing to do, time expands, it kind of drags and it drags. And the longer it went on, genuinely, I began to think, what if my parents are bombers? And what if they have left us in the car as kind of decoys or whatever? That's the kind of weird thinking that goes on. I also, you know, very much remember when mum and dad went out on a Saturday night. We lived in a, you know, a council estate. My aunt and uncle lived about three or four doors up. Another aunt and uncle lived around the corner. So, you know, they went out locally and we were left to our own devices. But again, the longer the night went on, maybe 11, half 11, I remember sort of standing, looking out the window, wondering not just when they would come home, but if they would come home, because obviously, you know, at the back of my mind, I knew that, you know, people going out on a Saturday night could get shot. The pub they were in could get blown up. So there was this kind of low level anxiety. I interviewed a poet from County Down called Leontia Flynn recently for the Irish Times, where I work as a journalist. And she said that people who live through the Troubles in the North suffer from low-level PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that's true. My mum said to me when I was something like 8 years old, this old neighbour who lived down the road in the estate, and she was the type of neighbour who, if you were playing football and the ball went over her hedge, she wouldn't give it back. So, you know, she wasn't the most popular of neighbours. Mum told me that she had died. And my response was, who shot her? In other words, I couldn't conceive of an elderly person dying of anything else other than violence. I couldn't conceive that death could be of natural causes, because on the news every night there was a daily digest of violence and death. And, you know, it obviously colored you know, my understanding of how the world worked.
I was going to say there's a lot of a small area, even just in the north, there's a lot of kind of trauma floating around, you know, like every one of those victims that you see, there's probably dozens of people who are deeply, deeply affected by their...
Absolutely. Yeah. The ripple effects of violence, you know, are enormous. Like, you know, one person is murdered. Like one of the people I interviewed, Richard Beattie, his father was blown up in a pub in Guildford. He was one of three Protestant civilians who were killed by the INLA, another Republican paramilitary organization. You know, Richard had four brothers and sisters. He had a mother who was widowed. He had, you know, grandparents who were bereaved, and that's just immediate blood relatives, obviously friends, neighbors. You know, when something like that happens, all of those people are traumatized, all of those people are bereaved, and it doesn't just happen once. Like, that's for the rest of their lives, you know. Personally, like, my wife passed away almost 10 years ago. So I have a personal understanding of bereavement, and I know that it's not, you know, it's not a one-off. It's something that, you know, your life is divided into like a kind of a before and an after. And so, like, that was like, I had a kind of a personal appreciation, and that is, like, you know, somebody who died of natural causes, if you like. If your loved one has been murdered, has died violently, you know, that inevitably complicates grief, because it didn't have to happen, it shouldn't have happened, and therefore people are living the rest of their lives with the knowledge that, you know, their father who was murdered when they were 18, they could have had them in their lives, you know, when they were in their 20s, in their 30s, going through life events like getting married, having children of their own. You know, that is such a loss for those people, and, you know, it shouldn't be forgotten. Like, you know, this book is, in its way, you know, one of the things that I wanted it to be was a kind of a memorial to these people, because I think a lot of people, you know, if you're not directly affected, you can kind of move on with your life. You know, something terrible happens to a neighbor or, you know, somebody that you work with. It's terrible, but human nature, you know, life goes on. But for those people's immediate circle, you know, okay, life goes on, but it is fundamentally changed, and changed for the worse. And I think those people deserve to be remembered. You know, there are other people, civilians, who died violently, who were murdered, who were shot dead on their doorstep, who were blown up in a shop waiting for a lift home. And there's no memorial to them. And I think that's wrong. I think everybody deserves to be remembered. I think there should be some means of commemorating everyone who died violently. For example, the Miami Show Band, it's quite a well-known case, this band who played in the Castle Ballroom in Banbridge and then were ambushed by loyalist paramilitaries masquerading as members of the security forces. So they were murdered by the side of the road, and there's a small plaque, you know, on the road between Banbridge and Newry, but it's a road that's been bypassed. It's not something that's in, you know, in common sight. My view would be there should be a plaque on the building where they played the night that they were murdered, so that people remember that story, so that people are kind of, if you like, confronted with the fact that not just members of the security forces, but ordinary civilians were murdered in their droves during the Troubles. I think it's important that everyone is remembered.
Right. I actually interviewed Stephen Travers not too long ago. I didn't know that the last gig they played was in your town.
Yeah, no, I've interviewed Stephen for my book as well, because A, there's the local connection, but also Stephen went on and moved to London and set up to help set up two Irish newspapers, the Irish World and what became the Irish and Britain News. And they were the first two newspapers that I worked on. And when I worked on another paper, the Irish Post, I commissioned Stephen to write a regular column on the music scene. So that was like a kind of a double connection, if you like. So, and again, the story of, you know, of my time when I was working on those newspapers in London, I came home on holidays and was in a local pub in Banbridge, and a guy that I was at school with, I went to a state school, which was effectively a Protestant school, so a small Catholic minority, if you like, and this guy comes up to me that I considered a friend, and he said to me, "I hear you're working for a Provo paper now." So Provo as in IRA, and, you know, and this was sort of said quite loudly in a pub, you know, full of strangers, and I thought it was just an incredibly reckless and dangerous thing to say. You know, obviously the paper I worked for, it was an Irish paper, but it was, you know, it absolutely was not a Republican paper. But you know, for him to say that in a kind of predominantly Protestant pub was, you know, was an incredibly dangerous and reckless thing to say.
Right. Okay. Again, maybe now more for the maybe more for the non-Irish kind of listeners. In some way, correct me if I'm wrong, in some way, like it is very much the division was very much based on religion, but I think in some ways religion was kind of a proxy for other things. Like I don't think that the most sectarian Catholic would have cared about or would have like disliked American Protestants or the most sectarian loyalist would have a problem with like Catholics in South America. It was more, it's not purely that once I just hate Catholics and others Protestants. Would I be right in saying there's a bit more to it than that?
Yeah, like, you know, this is going deep into the weeds of Irish history, I guess, but Protestants in the north of Ireland, you know, largely, if not exclusively, you know, descend from English and Scottish settlers who moved to Ireland in different ways of settlement or plantation, as it was called. In Ulster, in particular, from around, I think 1600, like, you know, the history of Ireland is part of the history of Ireland is, you know, invasion from England, or initially Normans, who, you know, who had come from initially France and then conquered England, and then they came across to Ireland and conquered parts of Ireland. So you had, you know, an English-Irish problem, if you like. But then post-Reformation, England, you know, turned Protestant, and therefore the kind of colonial relationship between Britain and Ireland was then further complicated by religion. So the English or British colonizers, you know, became Protestant, and then that led that, you know, so that kind of added a sectarian dimension, if you like, to the conflict between, you know, as was Native Irish and British settlers. So I certainly didn't grow up with a hatred or dislike of Protestants. I think it's more complicated, maybe. There obviously is sectarianism on both sides, but you know, it is a complex interweaving of, you know, I think for some on the Catholic side, there, you know, historic resentments of maybe, you know, having lost a sense of their family or their ancestors having been driven off their land or whatever by settlers. So that's like a kind of an underlying resentment, if you like. On the Protestant side, there is, you know, there have been, you know, atrocities and from both sides. Like in 1641, there was a rebellion in which, you know, a lot of Protestant settlers were killed by Catholics who had risen up hoping to kind of, you know, win their land back, if you like. So there is like a kind of a historic suspicion or fear of Catholics. Like people talk of the siege mentality, if you like, of Ulster Protestants, because they do feel beleaguered. They feel that, you know, on the island of Ireland they're very much a minority. In the north, they were where they were concentrated, you know, they were a majority, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why Ireland was partitioned, was because there was a concentration of Protestants in Ulster who wanted to remain part of Britain, of the United Kingdom, and you know, they had the support of significant elements of British society who wanted to kind of retain that link as well. But you know, you are right. Like, you know, by and large, people aren't fighting over, you know, whether or not The consecration at a Catholic Mass is, you know, the bread and wine turning into the body and blood of Christ. Though there are, you know, there are certain prejudices, whatever, like, for example, the Catholic veneration of the Virgin Mary to some Catholic or to some Protestants, that is Mariolatry. It is like kind of kind of worshipping of the Mother of God, if you like. So, you know, it would be wrong to sort of say that there's no substance to the sectarianism. There are, you know, people with, you know, extreme, like what I would consider extreme views. There are Protestants who wouldn't consider Catholics to be Christians. But to be honest, I think that division was in the States as well up until, you know, relatively recent times. There was a strong strain of anti-Catholicism in the United States. The boundaries, I think, have been blurred because of, you know, there's a, obviously a strong conservative element within Catholicism, you know, opposition to abortion, divorce, and so forth. So there is a kind of a coalition that has grown up between evangelical Protestants and conservative Catholics, which has maybe blurred boundaries which once were there in the States. Like, there have only been, I think, two Catholic presidents in the history of the United States,
Kennedy and who?
Biden. So, you know, I think that's evidence of the fact that, you know, Catholics were suspect in the United States for a long time as well. And, you know, in Britain, like, you know, Britain probably sees itself as, you know, a liberal post, you know, post-Christian society almost in many ways. And yet the, you know, the supreme ruler of the king or the of Britain, British royalty, you know, it's baked into the constitution, if you like, that they have to be Protestant, they have to be Anglicans. If a, you know, if one of them were to marry a Catholic, they're automatically excluded from access to the throne. So you might think this is kind of quaint and whatever, like, but, you know, it is evidence of, you know, of past prejudice, if you like, that that is still lingering in British society.
Speaking of speaking of like sectarianism and more like on an interpersonal level, there was a chapter in your book, I think it was called Cold House for Catholics, and in that you went into your schooling, you went to a majority Protestant school. There's something about kind of seeing sectarianism being done by children, especially kind of younger children, that makes it like particularly uglier. And I think it's the illogical nature of it, and the just the bad nature of it, I think it's a bit more transparent when kids are doing it, because I don't know, they're just kind of supposed to be more innocent, and like kids naturally won't care at all unless it's programmed into them. Can you tell us a bit about your schooling and how that kind of played into it?
Sure. So I guess, you know, I was probably quite innocent and naive, as you say. Like, you know, I grew up in a village called Lawrenstein, which was predominantly Catholic, though I did have some Protestant neighbours. But it really wasn't a thing. We did this exam called the 11 plus. If you passed it, you went to a grammar school. You know, the nearest grammar school was in Banbridge, 3 miles away, and it was a state, effectively a Protestant school. The nearest Catholic one was in Newry, that was 15 miles away on the border. So for whatever reason, I think maybe a naive ecumenism on my parents' part, they thought it'd be good, you know, to mix with people from the other community. I say naive because, you know, we weren't particularly welcomed there. Catholics were about 10% of the school population. I don't think there were any Catholic teachers. Like, there wasn't any hostility that I experienced from teachers particularly, but definitely from, I would say, you know, maybe 1 in 10 of the pupils in my year or whatever were, you know, actively sectarian. They would kind of call me a Fenian, a Taig, a rebel. I had to look up some of these names. I didn't really know what they meant or whatever. Like, I knew they were insults, but I didn't really know the derivation. Teg comes from Tig, which is the Irish for Timothy. So it's just like a kind of a common Irish name, which over time became associated with an abusive term for a Catholic. Fenian,
Like a pad.
beg pardon?
In England, they might say paddies, yeah.
For example, yeah. And then Fenian obviously is from, the Fenian Brotherhood, the forerunners of the IRA, if you like, an Irish, revolutionary organization, which existed in America as well as in Ireland. So, if you were Catholic, and because of, the troubles were going on, you were kind of perceived as being a supporter of the IRA, whether or not you were. And say if a local RUC man, policeman, or UDR man, the locally raised regiment of the British Army, if one of them was killed, well, that obviously, provoked a lot of anger among some of the pupils that I went to school with. And I was like a kind of a sitting duck. I was the kind of a handy outlet for, for their aggression, if you like. So I kind of felt, given that sectarianism was kind of baked into Northern Irish society, I kind of felt that the teachers at the school should have been aware of it and should have been kind of looking out for this small minority of Catholics in their care. But nobody ever asked the question. Nobody ever sort of, said, if there ever there's any problem with, sectarian abuse or name calling or bullying or whatever, be sure and come and tell us. So I kind of feel, because it wasn't addressed, because it wasn't even conceived of as an issue, there is a real culture in, among school children not to snitch, not to kind of go running to the teacher if, somebody says something or does something. So kind of I felt, no option other than to kind of suffer in silence. So like it was a kind of a tough experience. It's not that it totally dominated my school experience. I had good friends, whatever, but I did notice, for example, if I went out with a girl from the other community, there would be hostility, maybe from, if she had a brother or whatever in the school, they would, wouldn't be happy about it. There would be kind of, a lot of antagonism, a lot of comments, whatever. Like the term a cold house for Catholics, when David Trimble, the unionist leader, won the Nobel Prize along with John Hume, the nationalist leader, he acknowledged in his acceptance speech in Stockholm that Northern Ireland had been a cold house for Catholics. In other words, Catholics did not feel welcome in Northern Ireland, which was this, the rump of the island of Ireland, which, if you like, remained under British rule with, local self-government by unionists and only unionists for 50 years before it was abolished. So I kind of felt that the school was a bit like a microcosm of the North. Catholics were very much in the minority, and they were very much not accommodated. We were let in, but everything about the place, the Union Jack flew in front of the school. They sang the British National Anthem at Prize Day. On Remembrance Week or whatever in November, we'd be marched down to the local Anglican church to offer prayers for the British war dead. There were lots of experiences, that weren't great. And then I interviewed for the book a girl that I was at school with, a couple of years older than me, from the village, also Catholic, who went on to be a principal, a headmistress of a special needs school. She was appointed MBE, member of the British Empire, so she was given a British honour for her decades of service as a teacher. She also attended the Queen's funeral, the Queen of England's funeral. So this is somebody who, if you like, was a fine, upstanding member of the community. And yet she told me that, her career as a special needs teacher was almost sabotaged in the bud by her headmaster, our headmaster at Bambridge Academy, because even though she had the grades, when she applied to university, she was rejected by everyone. And she knew that people with lesser grades than her had been accepted. So she started asking around what might have happened. A cousin who is a teacher knew somebody at a teacher training college in Belfast, and he asked, if they would have a look at the application and see what had gone wrong. And the guy at the teacher training college came back and said that she had got a terrible reference from her headmaster at Bambridge Academy, that she was accused of having played truant, even though she'd never missed a day of school in her life. She was said that she was disruptive, et cetera, et cetera. So this, Protestant headmaster had tried to sabotage his Catholic pupils' prospects of becoming a special needs teacher. And the twist is that he himself had a child with special needs who was at another school in Banbridge, where my neighbour Paula had volunteered whilst a pupil at Banbridge Academy. And he had actually written her a letter thanking her for giving up her time to her free time to teach at this or to volunteer at this school. So, like, to me, that's one of the, and that's another reason why it's called Dirty Linen, because it's talking out of school. When I was at school, I didn't talk out of school. Well, decades later, this is me talking out of school. This is me washing the dirty linen in public, telling, uncomfortable truths that I think deserve to be told. The Troubles was not just about violence and murder. It was, it also had its roots in decades, if not centuries, of discrimination and sectarianism.
I actually a lady who was referenced in your book, Anne Cadwalder. I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago. She wrote Lethal Allies, probably the leading book on loyalist and British security forces collusion. We spoke about the group known as the Glenning Gang, particularly a very infamous figure named Robin Jackson. Now your area was very much in the kind of geographical area that they operated in, and I believe a man named Pat Campbell was he's suspected to be Jackson's first kill actually in several. What was it like growing up with this? I guess they were kind of a loose group, but this group went run around terrorizing the countryside, shooting mainly people who had no paramilitary involvement or anything, you know?
It was pretty chilling, to know that, the most notorious loyalist paramilitary, a serial killer who had the reputation for having, who had been linked to, by the time he died, he was linked to something like 50 murders, including the Dublin and Monaghan bombings,
And Miami Shoban massacre, possibly.
and the Miami Shoban massacre, and the murder of the O'Dowds, which I write about in the book, and the murder of the Cairns brothers, and the Blairy Darts Club shooting. Many of them, like, he is like a terrible thread running through my book. Pat Campbell, you mentioned. Pat Campbell was a Catholic who was shop steward, in other words, a trade union leader in the biggest local employer, Down Shoes, a shoe factory, where my mother worked, where my uncle worked. So Jackson himself worked in the shoe factory and was sacked for fighting with a local Catholic. He was also a member of the Ulster Defence Regiment, the locally raised British Army regiment. Pat Campbell was shot dead on his doorstep in 1973, 50 years ago, this month. His widow, Margaret, who had opened the door, identified Robin Jackson at an identity parade. But despite this, the police decided senior police officers, the people investigating, the police investigating the murder, wanted to charge him, and he was detained, he was arrested, and he was charged. But at a conference about 2 months after the murder, it was decided by senior police officers and the Crown Prosecution Service not to proceed. They decided that the witness evidence was not strong enough, but there is evidence from people who work for Army Intelligence, a man called Colin Wallace, that he was asking whether particular people could be targeted by his group. And he was told that Robin Jackson, at the request of REC Special Branch, was not to be targeted. There is a lot of evidence in Anne Cadwalader's Lethal Allies and elsewhere in police reports that Robin Jackson was protected by elements of the security forces and may well have been an agent of either the RUC or the British Army or MI5 or a combination of them. And that's hugely disturbing. There have been court cases like Pat Campbell's widow sued the British Ministry of Defence and the PSNI, the successors to the RUC, the local police force. It was settled out of court, but she received a significant sum. Pretty much a carbon copy of the case taken by the survivors and relatives of the Miami Shoban massacre, Stephen Travers, who we mentioned earlier. They also received a significant settlement out of court by the British Army. This,
sorry to cut in. It's worth mentioning that for the case that was brought by the Miami Shoban survivors, Robin Jackson actually should have been in court, but they were asked why. And someone from British Security Forces or RUC said, and this is a quote, for operational reasons. He's not here for operational reasons. Like, that's insane. That's really like saying the quiet part out loud. Like,
sure. Well, that goes back to the original investigation, like by the time of the payout, the actual the compensation award or the out of court settlement. Like he was dead. He died in 1998, but. You know, there was a catalogue of opportunities where he could have been arrested. Like he had been named 5 days, I think, before Pat Campbell was murdered. He was named by a man arrested who was found in possession of large amounts of explosives. And he named Robin Jackson as one of three people who had made him store this material. And if he was arrested, bearing in mind that he was a member of the Ulster Defence Regiment at this time. So you have a member of the security forces who has been named by a man caught red-handed with a large cache of arms and explosives. And then for whatever reason, you know, he wasn't arrested immediately. He wasn't arrested until after he had murdered Pat Campbell. If he had been arrested as he should have been, he wouldn't have been a free man to carry out that murder. And similarly, before the Miami Shoband massacre, he and two others had been caught firing shotguns, I believe, and again had not been arrested or charged, and therefore was again free to carry out the Miami Shoband massacre.
It kind of crosses paths at times. If you've read books about the Troubles, it'll like cross paths. It'll kind of interact with others. One of them was an ex. It's very much the anti-IRA book written by an ex-IRA man. It's called Killing Rage by Eamon Collins. And I'm not finished it yet, but I read in your book that a bomb that was that went off in your town, in Bansbridge town. It was actually driven there by Eamon Collins, and the book gives an account of a lady named Margaret who was lucky enough to survive a blast, but her life was completely altered afterwards. She was blinded. That's another thing the book did, is like obviously death is like, death is the most extreme form of violence, and if you're near a bomb and you survive it, like, geez, you thank your lucky stars. But at the same time, there's a lot of damage that doesn't show up in like a death stat, but that
absolutely that... Yeah, so like Margaret Yeaman, who you mentioned, so in that bomb that Eamon Collins ferried from Newry to Banbridge, a young schoolboy was murdered, was killed. He was waiting for a lift in a jeweler's across the road from where the bomb went off. So, you know, I kind of like the chapter that we discussed earlier, A Cold House for Catholics, in which I discuss, you know, the sectarianism that I experienced at school, you know, maybe quite deliberately, I juxtapose that with the chapter in which a Protestant schoolboy is murdered, is blown up by an IRA bomb, because, you know, whatever about discrimination, indiscriminate violence is so much worse. You know, I got over whatever I experienced at school. That young boy, Alan McCrum, you know, was robbed of the rest of his life. You know, his family, I wasn't able to track down any of his family, but I did manage to track down Margaret Yeaman, who was the woman blinded in the blast. One of the things that I discussed with her was the fact that her portrait was painted by Colin Davidson. There's actually an exhibition that's on in New York at the moment in the Irish Arts Centre, I believe, of his paintings of victims and survivors of the Troubles and their relatives. It's called Silent Testimony, and it's an incredibly powerful show. Like, his portrait of Margaret is in the book. He persuaded her to take off the dark glasses, which he normally wears, to cover up, you know, her damaged eyes. And, you know, it's heartbreaking, really. You know, he allowed her and her alone to actually touch his painting, because obviously she wasn't able to see it. So she, you know, he guided her fingers, whatever, so she could kind of smell the linseed oil or whatever and sort of feel the kind of swirls of paint. That to me was, you know, incredibly poignant. And also, you know, I'm already thinking, you know, everyone that I interviewed in the book, I'm sending a copy. Margaret, I have to make special arrangements and get a link so that she can have an audiobook, because of course, you know, she can't read it as such. Margaret, a lovely person and not at all a bitter person. And, you know, some of the little details, like, you know, she describes not wanting to leave the hospital. She says, who doesn't want to leave a hospital? But, you know, she was told they couldn't do anything for her eyes. She initially thought it was just her eyelids or something that was damaged. And just found it very hard to accept that she would never see again. Didn't want to come home. And then when she was home, you know, she didn't want to eat in front of her family because she felt, you know, self-conscious. So she would take her meals in the kitchen. And it's little details like that, that, you know, to me, get under the skin of, I think over time, we can become maybe not callous as in uncaring, but calloused as in, you know, if your hands are, you know, after digging with a spade all day, whatever, your hands become hard and kind of the skin becomes rough, whatever, and it's maybe hard to kind of get underneath the surface. You know, we become maybe emotionally spent, not unfeeling, but just sort of burnt out. And, you know, I really wanted, you know, where possible, to kind of, you know, make people feel again, make people actually, you know, I know a lot of people will kind of think, you know, the IRA were fighting, you know, to drive the British out of Ireland, as they would see it, or whatever, or defending their community. And maybe it started off, you know, there were times in Belfast when Catholics were getting burnt out of their homes, Protestants too. And, you know, vigilante groups would spring up and people would understandably want to protect their areas. That's one thing, and like I said, that's understandable. But when it comes to sort of setting off no warning bombs in town centres that kill innocent school children, shop assistants, and whatever from both communities, that's not a war for freedom. That's not defending your community. That is terrorizing everyone, ordinary people. Margaret had this wonderful friendship with a Catholic woman that she met through a victim support charity called WAVE. Colin Davidson, the painter that I mentioned, is the patron of the charity. Jennifer was one of the victims of one of the most notorious bombings early in the Troubles, the Abercorn bombing, Abercorn restaurant bombing in Belfast. Two young Catholic girls, young women, were murdered in this IRA bombing, which they didn't claim, but it was the IRA. And Jennifer and her sister, who was engaged to be married, they were having an afternoon cup of tea in the restaurant, having been shopping. And they were both grievously wounded. Jennifer lost both her legs. Her sister lost both her legs and an arm and an eye. But Jennifer is just such an incredibly strong and positive individual, and the friendship that she has with Margaret is something to behold. I interviewed them together in Jennifer's house in Belfast, as well as having in common the fact that they're both victims of bombings. They also have in common the fact that what happened to them has been transformed somehow into art. The Abercorn bombings in Belfast inspired, if that is the word, a sculptor from Banbridge, my hometown, Effie McWilliam, to devise a series of works called Women of Belfast, one of which is called Women in a Bomb Blast, and it depicts a woman being blown off her feet, her legs, her limbs akimbo by the force of a blast. It's one of the most, powerful or memorable artistic depictions of the 30 years of conflict. And so I wanted to kind of juxtapose the stories of Margaret, who's been painted by Colin Davidson in the Silent Testimony series, and her friend Jennifer, who is also a victim and who is depicted by Effie McWilliam. But I guess, what I wanted as well to convey is just the courage and the resilience of the people, whether they are relatives of victims or are themselves victims of terrible violence, and yet have somehow managed to survive, and if not thrive, at least to kind of have a wonderful spirit with which to kind of endure and persevere. So I want to make people stop and think and feel, but I don't want it to be unrelenting misery, and I hope, I don't think it is. I think there is a positive thread through the book, which is just what I have said, this kind of uplifting courage of, part of what it is to be human is to be hurt and to be damaged, but somehow to endure, to survive. And I hope that kind of spirit is something that people will take away with, that there are positives to take away from all of this. Again, coming back to the linen metaphor, the book ends, I won't give it all away, but the book ends with an anecdote that my grandfather told. I came across some recordings that he did with a local teacher. He lived until 94, and he was born in 1890, so he was able to sort of talk about, his own time working in the linen industry. He was put out of work along with every other Catholic around 1920, around the time of the violence around partition. He touched on that. He touched on other things in his life, but he sort of describes this incident around the time of the Second World War when the linen industry was revived because they were using linen for the canvas covering of airplane wings. And so parts of the industry that had been abandoned were kind of reopened, and they kind of found when they reopened a dam in the River Ban, they found at the bottom of it a bundle of flax, which they somebody said, well, that'll be ruined, that'll be useless. But he said, no, you know, take it out and thresh it, if you like, and scotch it is the term, and the fabric inside will actually be as good as it was 50 years ago. And he was right. And I end with on that note as a kind of, you know, a note of hope, I guess, that despite everything, despite, you know, decades of conflict and violence and the legacy of hurt and harm, you know, there is, you know, the husk might be rotten, but inside there is, you know, fabric which can be won, can be woven and spun into something beautiful, like pure Irish linen. So, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about it. I don't want to sort of say everything is fine and dandy. It's not. There still are huge, you know, social problems and divisions. But, you know, there is a new generation growing up that is, I think, less divided and embittered than previous ones. And I do think, you know, there is hope for a better, brighter future for the part of the world in which I grew up.
Very good. I'll let you go very soon. If I might just ask you one more thing, there's something around
that. Sure.
There was a quote from a bomb blast survivor towards the end of the book. It's he said, terrorism is done by very few. It mesmerizes many and terrorizes many more. On that note, what for you is the line between someone being a freedom fighter and someone being a terrorist? Because, you know, we don't look back. We don't look back on Michael Collins and Tom Barry and them as being terrorists in any way. They were very much freedom fighters. So where for you is the difference between them?
Yeah, like, I guess, you know, terrorist is not a word that I've used in the book. I don't think it's a word that we use in the Irish Times either. It's maybe quite loaded. Like, we talk about paramilitaries, you know, I guess because, you know, some of the, you know, there is no doubt, though, that the paramilitaries in the north, as well as, you know, elements in the British Army, they did terrorize people. That is a fact. The difference, I would say, well, without a doubt, if you are targeting civilians, you know, how is that fighting for anyone's freedom? You know, if you're killing members of the security forces, you know, who, you know, are not out waging war on their fellow citizens, how is that winning freedom? Like, if you look back to the War of Independence, which you're referring to there, Michael Collins and Tom Barry and so forth, you know, that was at a time when there had been a general election in Ireland and a majority of the Irish people had voted for Sinn Féin, had voted for a party whose policy was United Ireland. And that democratic wish was being thwarted by the British government, by the British state. And the British Army at the time in the island of Ireland was acting in a very repressive way. So what you had there was a national war of independence. Now, even at that time, there was actually very little IRA activity in the north of Ireland in what became Northern Ireland, the six counties that became Northern Ireland, for the reason that, you know, Catholics there were very much in the minority. And when there were IRA actions in Belfast or whatever, there were terrible repercussions for the Catholic community there. And they suffered terribly. There was very little IRA activity in my neighborhood. The local RIC station was burned down, but it had already been abandoned. Seamus Monaghan, who was the leader of the IRA in my locality, he bemoaned the fact that there was very little support for for armed violence there, that people were sort of that they weren't supportive. And again, I think the circumstances were such that it wasn't viable to wage war in the north, or certainly in that part of the north, like it was in Cork or Clare or whatever. And therefore, when the Provisional IRA or their, Sinn Féin, their political wing as was, when they sort of make comparisons or whatever, they don't sort of home in on that very much, I don't think. They don't acknowledge the fact that first time around, when there was a very active war of independence being waged in Cork and in Dublin and other parts of Ireland, there was relatively little activity in the north. Sorry, that's long-winded, and I would say, I'm not a historian, so I don't claim to, to speak with huge authority on the kind of macro questions, if you like. I'm a journalist, and my focus is very much, this is very much a kind of a local history and a personal history, and it's very much victim-centered. It's letting those people tell their stories. And I stand over 100% everything, that is in the book and the stories that they tell. And I think, if you read those stories, I think you will come away with a fuller appreciation and understanding of why, what happened to those people was not a war of independence, or it was not a war that should have been fought. It certainly was a war that could not be won. Like, you can categorically say that 3,700 deaths later, are we really that much closer to a united Ireland? It's my firm belief that a united Ireland will eventually happen, but if and when it does happen, it will be through democratic means. And I think, that opportunity was there in the late 1960s with the Civil Rights Campaign, which was a broad-based campaign of peaceful protest, which brought together not just Catholics but Protestants and trade unionists. And I think that was the way, firstly, to a fairer, better Northern Ireland, but also I think in time it would have evolved into, as Southern society evolved and became less of a theocracy, of less of a state dominated by the Catholic Church, as it became more prosperous. I genuinely think, if the North had not descended into 30 years of violence, I think we would be a lot closer to a united Ireland than we otherwise are.
Interesting. Sorry, if I might fill in one more thing there.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned you were born in 67, so that
Yeah.
first death that occurred in your area, you were about six. Most of it, you would have been quite young. Obviously, when you're a kid, you kind of don't know any different, and you don't kind of know why things happen. They just kind of do. It's all above your head. Like, what was it like going back and filling in with, say, like contextual gaps in your own memory? Like, I'm sure you remembered a lot of stuff that happened when you were a kid, but you wouldn't have known at the time the links or the causes, or even if the Glenan gang were a particular group. It might have seemed more random. You kind of filled in. The book must have been an activity in filling in like your memory in terms of the context, yeah.
Absolutely. Like I grew up knowing that classmates didn't have a father. I didn't always know that that one didn't have a father because he was blown up He was a lorry driver who was blown up in an IRA bomb that went off prematurely at a customs post on the border in Newry. I knew that another classmate's father had been shot dead, but I didn't know any details. I didn't know that he had been shot dead in a darts club along with two other people, and that it was 2 days after his son had won an All-Ireland boxing title in Dublin. I didn't, my parents, like the policeman who was shot dead in Guildford, we were in Dublin visiting family when that happened, and my parents, kept that from us. They didn't want to upset us. So I absolutely, I kind of thought growing up that the Troubles kind of, passed me by, whatever, because a lot of the kind of the early murders, I was 5 or 6 or whatever. And then other ones, my parents kind of, I think rightly kind of wanted to shelter us as much as possible from awareness of how close to home the violence was. The stuff about the Glenan gang, absolutely, there was, I probably grew up thinking that a lot of like there was, the Republican movement made a lot of claims, and I guess I, they made a lot of allegations about police brutality, about British Army brutality, about collusion between loyalist paramilitaries and the security forces. And I guess I did, part of me kind of think that, well, it might be true, but it might well just be loyal or Republican propaganda. And actually, a lot of things that allegations that they made at the time, I now believe actually are true. I believe they are true, but at the same time, I don't believe that the IRA's campaign of violence was in any way justified. I kind of think about the North a bit like, without any spoilers to any Agatha Christie fans, I kind of look at it like one of her famous books, in which there wasn't one culprit, there were several. So having researched and written this book, it confirms me in the belief that, there were many fingers on the trigger. There are many people responsible for the 30 years of violence. IRA paramilitaries in the IRA, loyalist paramilitaries, elements of the British security forces, both locally and in Britain, and MI5, etc. It was a very dirty war. And the people I feel, most passionately about are the victims on all sides. The innocent victims on all sides, whose lives were ruined, were they were playthings for, for people who had very little scruple or care.
Thank you very much, though, for all your time. Anyone who's listened to this, please buy the book. It's absolutely fantastic. Easily one of the best books I've ever read about any conflict, to be honest. But the Troubles.
So I guess I should say, just to be clear, that so the book is called Dirty Linen: The Troubles in My Home Place by myself, Martin Doyle, and it's published by Merrion Press on October the 18th.
Very good. We'll put a link in both the YouTube and the podcast for it. Is there anything else you want to leave us with? Any final thoughts before we go?
No, I think, I think the last thing I said is my conclusion.
Very good. Thank you very much for all your time, Martin. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. All right. Thank you.